Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the How Should I Be Positioned podcast here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. As you know, on this podcast, we do like to catch up with our industry colleagues and partners to discuss the market and macro environment, along with thinking when it comes to asset allocation. So we are excited to welcome back to our 1285 podcast studio here in New York, Torsten Slok, partner and chief economist with Apollo. Torsten, I believe this is your third appearance with us, so it's great to have you back. To my right today, we have Jason Dreho, head of asset allocation with the UBS Chief Investment Office. So, Torsten, Jason, thank you for getting together. It's great to be with you both and looking forward to hearing your thinking today.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having us. And I should also mention, thank you very much for having Apollo. We're also here with our great colleagues, Hilary Roman and Haley Wrights, and we really appreciate that you want to talk to us today.
Absolutely. It's a terrific partnership between UBS and Apollo, so I'm glad we're all here today. So there is a lot to talk about. I first want to acknowledge to start that we are recording here on Monday, April 15, to provide our listeners, our clients, with a bit of context when we're having this conversation. Though with that, have to acknowledge what an eventful few weeks it has been in the markets, and this accounts for, Torsten, the abundance of macro data releases, some of which surprising to the upside. I know we had retail sales today. We think back to that March CPI print, combined with the rising geopolitical tensions we're experiencing as well. So given that, Torsten, how have these factors impacted your U.S. macroeconomic outlook?
Yeah, the way we look at things is that we have had a Federal Reserve that up until December was saying interest rates are going up, interest rates are going up, interest rates are going up. And that provided a backdrop for a lot of things in capital markets, where you had a situation where there was very little IPOs, very little M&A, very little issuance in IG, very little issuance in high yield and loans, because you had an environment where rates going up meant that there was a lot of uncertainty about how much are interest rates going to go up. That changed dramatically on the December 13 FOMC meeting when the Fed came out and said, you know what? Now rates are no longer going up. Now the next move in rates will be down. That meant that a lot of people jumped down from the fence and said, well, if interest rates are about to go down, maybe I should be putting money into investment grade credit, into high yield credit, maybe into private credit. Maybe the opportunity was there because of yields going down meant that you could get in while interest rates were peaking. The other consequence of that was also that the stock market since November the 1st has been rallying 25%. So that was the prior FOMC meeting before the December FOMC meeting. And remember that the market cap of the S&P 500 is about $44 trillion. So when the S&P is up 25%, that means that we have added to household balance sheets an astonishing $11 trillion in wealth since the December FOMC meeting. And that means that we have had a significant tailwind to job growth, significant tailwind to inflation. And in the latest data we got here, we now also have a significant tailwind to consumption, simply because the wealth effect has been so significant. Just to put some numbers into that, well, the total gain of the stock market plus the gain of the bond market is roughly around 13, 14 trillion. Remember, consumer spending last year was about 19 trillion. So that means that the wealth gain we have seen in the last 4 or 5 months corresponds to 70% of consumer spending in 2023. So the bottom line in how we look at things at the moment is, yes, the next move from the Fed, they may say that it's a cut and it will eventually come down the road, but it certainly has unleashed a significant increase in wealth and therefore significant increase, therefore also in consumer spending on everything from hotels, airlines, restaurants, sporting events, concerts, whereby the consumer and the economy just continues to do well. So the short answer to your question is we still see the economy is actually doing quite well, mainly fueled here at the moment by the very significant tailwind coming from easy financial conditions and in particular the big rise we've had in the stock market.
So Torsten, I want to pick up on that point about the easier financial conditions. If we go back 2 years ago when the Fed first started hiking rates, there's been a lot of debate about like, you know, how tight is monetary policy. People look at the Fed funds rate. They can look at it relative to what they think is neutral, and there's a lot of reassessment of what neutral is.
Exactly.
There's been, let's see, almost a little bit of a two camps in terms of, you know, how monetary policy affects the economy. One is kind of this financial conditions, like that's what really matters. And as it eases or tightens, that's going to have a positive growth impulse or negative. There's the other view that, you know, it all comes down to these long and variable lags of high rates. So high rates, I mean, it's still around 5.5%. So what you've described to me would imply a view, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that you think that ultimately it's these changes in financial conditions that are what matter much more as opposed to the actual level of absolute rates. And therefore, people are waiting for those longer variable lags. They're going to be waiting a long time for those lags to come in. Is that, do you think that's what really matters at this point in time? It's really changes in financial conditions that drive growth more so than the absolute level of rates?
Yeah, I agree. I think what's very important exactly about what you're saying, Jason, is that the Fed started raising rates. And what were the consequences of that? Well, that had negative consequences on consumers, on firms, and on banks. But it only had negative consequences for certain consumers, namely consumers that had a lot of debt, certain firms, namely firms that had a lot of debt, and certain banks, in this case the regional banks, but banks that generally were more exposed to interest rates going up. So the key, in my view at least, the key way to think about that is that, yes, when the Fed started raising rates, the textbook would have predicted that we began to see a negative impact on certain consumers, on certain firms, and on certain banks. But I would have thought that the long and variable lags, as you're saying, would have come in much quicker. But because consumers were prepared for higher rates, because most consumers have 30-year fixed mortgages, they were locked into that, and they did not refinance as mortgage rates went up to 7-8%. Likewise, firms had termed out their debt, so also firms were less vulnerable to interest rates going up. And many banks also were relatively prepared because they have been benefiting from the level of yields going up and therefore the net interest margin looking better. So I would view that as it was playing out exactly as the textbook and the Fed would have predicted, namely higher interest rates were slowing down certain segments of consumers, certain segments of firm, namely those that have more leverage and for firms that have lower coverage ratios. But it, when the Fed then came in December and said, well, we're not stopping that process, and now we're turning around and saying, well, now inflation is no longer such a big deal, that then unleashed the easing in financial conditions that has overwhelmed that negative initial force of interest rates going higher. So I view that as the different components of financial conditions. That's, yes, some parts of financial conditions are still weighing heavily on firms with a lot of leverage. But at the same time, the dramatic gain in wealth is now overwhelming that negative effect that still is playing out in the background. So call that a sugar high coming from the stock market going up that's lifting things, while we at the same time still have the process of slowing things down in the background because of high interest rates.
For me, it's a burger high, but, you know, to each his own. So just maybe a two-part question to kind of follow up on this. One, then, is given the data we've seen for March, and if you look at three-month moving averages, it would suggest, you know, higher wind is picking up, inflation is picking up. So would you say the economy is accelerating? And if this is due to these easing of financial conditions, when does the maximum kind of growth impulse hit and when does it fade? And if it doesn't, I know you're correct or wrong, but like you're in the call right now, like no Fed cuts this year.
Yeah, that's right.
So is at some point this sugar high, burger high fade and the economy will slow? Do you think the Fed actually would need to raise rates to kind of ultimately kind of bring things down? Like eventually those rates will, and the growth impulse from the easier financial conditions will ease. Like think about like the dynamics of how we're playing out. Does it get better before it sort of stuck, like the sugar high crashes at some point later on?
Yeah, I do think that that's, I agree with that and exactly the way you explain it, namely that we had a hike from the Fed that was beginning to slow things down. It certainly slowed things down in the banking sector for the regional banks. There were a lot of problems, as we know, about a year ago. And a lot of these problems are still somewhere in different shapes and forms in the background. But with the sugar high of the stock market since November the 1st going up 25%, adding more than 10 trillion in wealth to the household balance sheet, then your main question really is, as you are saying, namely, how long time would that continue? Could that be that the stock market, as we have been seeing in the last few weeks, the stock market still wants to go up, despite that rates have moved up a lot, despite long rates have moved up, despite that the market is now saying, well, maybe the Fed will not be cutting as many as 3-4 times. Maybe they only cut twice or once, or maybe, in my view, they may not even cut this year. The market, in the stock market, is still saying, we want to go higher, we want to go higher, we want to go higher. That could be for AI stories, Magnificent Seven. Even that's becoming a little bit more complicated with a big diversion between the Magnificent Seven in terms of performance. But I would still say that as long as the stock market wants to go up, we will still have that sugar high having a longer runway. So if the stock market continues to do well, then I still think that the wealth gain people are getting from, again, stock prices going up, home prices going up, even crypto prices have gone up. You also see in fixed income, because yield levels are so high, households are getting very significant cash flows from fixed income every single month. So in some ways, the household balance sheet has never been in better shape than it is today. And if that's the case, that does argue to your question that we could have several quarters where you could still have solid consumer spending because of this sugar high, as we're calling it, the tailwind of easy financial conditions still supporting consumption and CapEx and GDP.
So then what brings down consumer spending if that's the case? Because it could become self-perpetuating. The more they spend, the economy is good. Asset prices continue to go higher. They spend more. At some point, we know like from past cycles, like things kind of break. Consumers will perhaps start taking on debt, though that pristine, relatively pristine balance sheets get worse. But to have any disruption, like what causes that? If it's not going to be rates, is it signs of weakness in the labor market, which we're not seeing any of those in any significant way? Like, you know, it almost sounds too good to be true. So where's the cracks in the armor, at least from the consumer?
This is extremely important because I think that the main crack at the moment is that inflation is just not coming down. So no matter how you look at it, if you look at core inflation, if you look at headline inflation, if you look at super core, if you look at trim mean or median, whatever measure of inflation you look at, if you look at it, 12 months change, the trend is looking better. But if you look at the 6 and the 3 months change, then the trend is actually beginning to pick up. And why do you want to look at the 3 and 6 months change? Because it tells you something about momentum in the economy. And given we're trying to find out what is the momentum since the easing of financial conditions that came with the November and December FOMC meeting, since that momentum has been building up, it becomes pretty important to look at what the 3 months and 6 months change in inflation is doing. And that has just been really beginning to move higher. So I think of the main answer to your question, Jason, that the risk is that inflation might begin to pick up again. And the market therefore have to go back and revisit the 2022 narrative, which of course was really bad for equities, really bad for rates, really bad for the 60-40 portfolio, because in 2022, rates are going higher, stocks were going lower. This was just the worst thing for financial markets. And if the risk is that we're just not done fighting inflation, well, then the risk is that we might come back and revisit, maybe it's like 2022, where stock markets have to sell off and rates have to move higher.
Given your assumption of no Fed cuts this year, where do you see inflation at year end versus today? You know, like C4, you know, headline higher or lower than where it is right now?
Yeah, so I do see all measures of inflation lower, but I think that the bottom line will probably be a fairly bumpy road if we need to get through the sugar high. Because think about it. If you look, for example, at the conference board has an indicator where they ask households in their sentiment survey, are you planning to travel abroad in the next 6 months? And this is at the highest level ever in the history of the data, which goes back to the 60s. In other words, more American families are now planning to travel outside the country than we have ever seen before. That doesn't sound like a recession to me, because a travel or a trip abroad, of course, is something that normally would be perceived as something that's a bit more luxury, that at least requires a little bit extra money. So the fact that households today, in the latest data for March, is now saying we are ready and we want to travel abroad more than we have ever done before, that's telling me that we are just not quite there yet in terms of the, again, the sugar high, the tailwind coming from easy financial conditions. So that's why I still think inflation for the next several months could begin to creep further up. But the Fed will then, in that case, keep rates even higher for longer than what markets are currently pricing. And eventually, as you said earlier, we will get that slowdown. And there's a risk that that slowdown could be a lot harder than what markets currently are expecting. So that's why it feels like an unstable equilibrium at the moment, where we have both, hey, things are great, there's a big tailwind, but ultimately, if interest rates have to stay higher, or as Larry Summers has been saying, maybe interest rates need to go up from here, well, that will then come with a risk that we ultimately will get that harder landing that we've been fearing for the better part of last year.
Well, because of my job, I can see data like, you know, the survey expectations of travel abroad. So being smart, I bought my ticket to Europe 2 months ago for the summer before the price doubles in another 6 weeks or so. Thinking then about the Fed, so no cuts this year, that's your forecast. What would you say is the threshold for them to actually want to hike rates at this point in time? Because they can just keep extending, like take out any cuts for next year and say like, you know what, you know, we're just good and we'll just kind of ride this out. Because it does seem like they have a pretty clear bias to wanting to ease. I mean, I kind of look over the past year, going back to when Silicon Valley went under last, you know, March, they were very quick to provide all the liquidity that was needed. So a little bit of times, even when inflation was high, like when push came to shove, they responded and provided support to the markets, like a little bit of sign like they don't want things to, you know, a recession. They've been pretty quick at different points of time, even going back to the summer of 22, when inflation was still high, to be willing to like, oh, now the inflation problem is solved.
Yeah.
So it seems like my kind of informal read would be they want to bring inflation down, but they don't want to do it at the cost of a recession. And if it takes them 1 year longer than maybe they would have projected otherwise, they're willing to kind of tolerate it. And so the bar for them to want to raise rates at this point in time is really high. They will tolerate like 5 years to go from 3% to 2% if it means we avoid a recession. Because I think they're not doing welfare economics exactly, but I think their calculus is that the economic cost of having 3 million people lose their jobs is not worth the additional benefits of going from 3 to 2.6% inflation. So it's the Larry Summers argument, I get it. You always have to put some probability, but that seems like it's a really, really high bar, given everything the Fed has essentially told us over the past year or so.
I agree. And as we have heard several FOMC members, including John Williams, more recently say, well, we want to normalize interest rates. And you stop up and say, well, hold on, what does normalize mean? Well, that's implicitly saying that the Fed funds rate today is 5.5. And the Fed has, in a lot of their weekend reading working papers, they have this idea that in the long run, the Fed funds rate should be what the Fed calls R star. And R star is a Fed invented concept, which is basically in their estimates around 2.5. And why do they talk about R star and 2.5 as a magic number? Because that's, in their view, the level of the Fed funds rate that we need to get back to. If, in their view, interest rates are below 2.5 or below R star, the economy will be booming. If we are above, the economy will be slowing down. So R star is the new magic equilibrium level that we're trying to go to in the long run. So they will say, and this is what they say when they talk about it in their speeches at the moment, if the Fed funds rate today is 5.5, in the long run, it should be 2.5, which, by the way, is also the long run dot in the dot plot that they publish after each FOMC meeting. If we are going to 2.5, that means by definition, interest rates are too high today. So that's why, exactly as you're saying, I agree that I don't think that they will be raising rates more, because they already feel that 5.5 is much higher than the 2.5 where they should be in the long run. So that's why they are so keen on normalizing interest rates and saying, let's get interest rates down, because we got to get down to 2.5, because that's where we want to be in the long run. But the problem is, what if that 2.5 is not calculated the right way? Larry Summers, others have been saying, that's not 2.5, that's more like 4 point something. In other words, maybe we're not too far away from where we want to be in the long run. And there could be some reasons why inflation and rates could be higher in the long run. We could have everything from deglobalization. It could be energy transition. It could also be the fact that we have more defense spending, which is all inflationary, but all argues for higher interest rates. We don't really know the effects of these three different forces. So therefore, we don't really know exactly what the benchmark is in terms of where we should be relative to 5.5. So therefore, the answer to your question and the way I look at it is that, well, yes, the Fed might want to normalize interest rates, but if inflation is still going up, if non-farm payrolls are still strong, if retail sales are still strong, it's just really, really difficult for them to cut interest rates, at least at this point where we're sitting at the moment.
On this neutral point, so the Fed is, you know, their dot plot of the projections are like 2.6%. It went up slightly over the last meeting.
Yep.
You can see a variety of reasons why they want to be slow in adjusting that. It's a little bit like sort of acknowledging maybe a 2% inflation target is not the right target. You know, only once inflation is down will they want to say maybe neutral is, you know, is not 2.5. It could be 3 or 3.5. Market pricing as of like this morning is close to 4, based on different implied measures of like where the neutral rate is.
Yep.
What is your thoughts on where sort of neutral would be given the macro environment you laid out? And look, there's all sorts of issues of like, what is a short term, medium term, long term? But like, as a practical matter, for the next 2 to 3 years, what do you think is sort of realistically kind of a neutral level of interest rates?
Yeah, so I think in the near term, and everything we have talked about here so far is all about that in the near term, there's a tailwind coming from easy financial conditions. There's a tailwind coming from the stock market going up. There's a tailwind coming from credit spreads tightening. That's all helping consumption. That's helping CapEx. That's helping GDP. I think all that argues for in the next several quarters, which is a very short term, we should have interest rates higher for longer. But exactly as you're saying, those three forces I highlighted earlier, they are above and beyond even this year and next year. And those things are that, most importantly, deglobalization, if we, and we'll see who wins in November and if we get more tariffs or not. But it's very clear that there is definitely a trend of onshoring, friendshoring, nearshoring. And if I have to buy my shirt or my tie or my toys for my kids in produced in the US instead of produced in China or Mexico, then it will also be more expensive and that will be inflationary, I don't know. So I think deglobalization argues in the longer run for a higher R star or a higher level of interest rates and a higher level of inflation. Energy transition, if we now are switching away from fossil fuels to more renewable energy, that's also going to be more costly, should also be inflationary. And finally, as I said, defense spending. Also, defense spending is, of course, we do defense spending for good reasons, but it just happens to be that this is also inflationary. So that's also a force that's putting upward pressure on the level of inflation. And finally, just thinking about the level of rates, we also have a very high government debt level. So there are a lot of new academic papers and papers from the Fed that are beginning to say, well, maybe rates are not only higher because of deglobalization, energy transition, and defense spending, but maybe also because of debt levels being so high, we run the risk that the term premium is going to be higher. So the answer to the question of where do we think interest rates will be in the long run, I think the market is right that we will have a 4% Fed funds rate in the long run. And I think that the term premium, meaning how much do you have to put on top of that to get to 10-year interest rates, will probably be as much as 0.5% to 1%. So that means that 4% Fed funds rate in the long run, and I think that the 10-year rate will probably be somewhere like 4.5% to 5%.
So you touched on a lot of important long-term structural trends, you know, the deglobalization, energy transition, didn't even touch on AI, but that's obviously, you know, a multi-year story playing out. all worthy of like another kind of podcast, but maybe we kind of, you know, table that for another time, is we take kind of this layout that we've kind of, or this macro environment we've discussed, which I think we're both relatively constructive in terms of the growth environment. To me, like the Fed, even if they're not cutting, they want to cut. So to me, like the Fed put is there. Yeah. To some extent. So again, it's sort of, you know, relatively constructive for risk assets. Given all that, given what you've just laid out in terms of where you think a neutral Fed funds rate would be, thinking about asset allocation, investing in the opportunities, and maybe start on the fixed income side, do you think then like the 10-year at 4.6% as it is right now, that's a reasonable level? Do you expect it to go lower this year? Could it go over 5%? Could we go to 5.5%? Like, how do you think about the distribution perhaps of the 10-year for the rest of this year?
Yeah, so I think, and starting with fixed income, I think a very important backdrop for everything we have talked about is that if the conclusion to everything we're saying here is higher for longer, and higher for longer is at the moment, normally, at least in the Bloomberg, CNBC and media and the normal press, it's meant as short rates higher for longer. But I also think, to your question about long rates, I actually also think long rates are going to be higher for longer because we have these forces we just talked about that are going to put upward pressure. So what should investors do if we now are in a regime where interest rates, broadly speaking, across the yield curve, is going to be higher for longer? Well, I think that obviously makes the investment implications almost the complete opposite of what we did from 2008 to 2022. That means that you have to be, in particular, in front-end fixed income. So that's 3 and 5 years and in fixed income. You can, of course, be in money markets. It's very safe. But especially in private credit, you can also get some very interesting returns that are historically at very high levels relative to where we've been before. And even if the Fed does begin to cut rates, you will still get a much higher coupon, a much higher yield than what you've been able to get from 2008 to 2022, simply because the level of yields is so higher. And especially if you go up in quality, your first lien, senior secured, large cap, the best protection you can get in up in quality, especially with the right covenants in place in private credit, you can get some yields that are substantially higher than what you can get in money market. So that's broadly saying, in the front end, I especially like fixed income and a fixed income spread product that trades above and beyond what you get in money markets. In long rates, I'm a little bit worried about a topic which we could have another whole podcast about, namely treasury issuance. The problem is treasury issuance over the next several quarters is in 2024 going to grow across the yield curve by 35% relative to where it was last year. So that means that if we're going to issue a lot more 5-year, 7-year, 10-year paper, that means that we will have a significant testing of the limits of how much demand is there when we increase supply, in particular increasing supply of duration. So I'm a little bit worried about going further, 5, 7, 10 year and 30 year in particular, about, well, what are the risks if I buy the 10-year rate at, say, 450, 460, that I may run the risk that maybe rates are not only today going up because the economy is strong, but maybe they're actually also going up because we have a debt problem. And if that's the case, then I would rather be in the front end of the yield curve in fixed income, in particular in spread product, on top of the treasury curve, because I think that that's a safer place to be.
So it sounds like in general for, say, the 10-year, a little more symmetric in terms of how it could play out. You could go higher certainly this year, but it doesn't sound like you think it would go much lower. The curve stays inverted, with the Fed's not going to cut, so the 2 years shouldn't be going lower.
Exactly.
Curve steepener trades have been very popular among hedge funds. You're clearly not a fan of that, I would gather.
I still think it eventually will work out, but of course it will be delayed now that the Fed cuts are being delayed.
Delayed, okay.
So you're right.
So that's the fixed income side. On equities, you know, the macro environment you laid out should be supportive of equities. At the same time, you know, the pushback you'd get is like, well, the multiples at 21 times on a forward basis, it's relatively expensive.
Yep.
You know, some of the stocks that have done very well have driven the markets higher. You wonder how much higher can some of these, like, you know, the Magnificent Seven stocks go. So do you see upside in equities over the next, let's say, you know, 12 months, the end of year? Is it more of like you have to be rotate to certain areas? So the overall level might not go up, but if you pick the right sectors or styles, things like that, you can have great performance. So it becomes more of an alpha or relative market versus a beta market.
Yeah, so absolutely. So thinking from the macro backdrop that we have talked about, if the conclusion is rates higher for longer, on its own, rates higher for longer means higher debt servicing costs for firms. That means that firms that are vulnerable to interest rates staying higher for longer will have much more interest expenses, and that will be a problem for highly levered companies, in particular triple C companies, companies that have high leverage, and especially companies in tech growth and also in venture capital. Venture capital is very unattractive in this environment because by definition in venture capital, you invest in firms that have no earnings, that have no cash flow, that have no revenue. And if that's the case, that means that these companies, if interest rates stay higher for longer, will continue to have debt servicing costs that are high while they at the same time have no earnings and have no revenue to cover those debt servicing costs. So that means, in other words, that the coverage ratio has to be high. It has to be high quality companies, large cap companies, because these are the ones that generally do best when interest rates stay higher for longer. So all that would argue for rates higher for longer. Actually, it says equity should go down, because that means that all companies across the board will be having higher debt servicing costs. At the same time, if rates are higher for longer, it would be because the economy is good. So exactly as you're saying, I agree that if the economy is good, earnings should be good. And that means that equities and credit should also be trading well. So I'm torn between, well, if rates are higher for longer, that's generally not good, as we saw in 2022. That's generally not good for credit, for high yield. IG could be a little bit better, but especially not for equities on their own. But if you at the same time have a strong economy, then everything is fine and then earnings will be fine. So I do think net at this point, strong economy will probably be dominating. So I do think equities generally will be interesting from a beta perspective. But the challenge is we have this 800-pound gorilla of higher rates for longer that can continue to bite harder and harder and ultimately create that risk that we'll have a sharper slowdown. So that's why I do think, exactly as you said, it's about picking the right stocks, picking the right styles, and in credit, selecting the right credits to make sure that you're not vulnerable to interest rates staying higher for longer and debt servicing costs staying higher for longer. And that generally means buy high quality companies, companies that are larger, not middle market. Middle market is very much at risk if rates, because companies generally there don't have much diversification in their cash flow. So higher for longer means large cap, bigger companies, companies that have good cash flows, companies that have solid earnings should generally, and of course generally higher coverage ratios and lower leverage levels should generally be doing well.
In an environment where rates are higher for longer, certainly publicly public listed companies that are more speculative, I think they're going to be squeezed by more. You mentioned venture capital. I would think that that is, when I've looked at this in the past, like that tends to be much more driven by, you know, the story you're telling. Because, you know, if you're doing
including
like first or second
AI like great things.
Because so I think the debt story, and you can look at the 90s, right? The dot-com era, the 10-year was at 6%, and yet there was massive kind of, you know, mania and speculation. So I don't think that's in the startup space. I think it's a different driver.
And I think sorry for interrupting, but I think that's really, really important, because last year suddenly dumped down in front of us the AI story. It didn't matter what inflation was doing. It didn't matter what interest rates were doing. Everyone wanted to have AI, and the Magnificent Seven was trading very, very highly correlated. But in the last 3-4 months, as you know all too well, you have really seen a significant divergence inside the Magnificent Seven, with Tesla, Apple, and Alphabet doing not particularly well. And you have had Meta and Nvidia doing really well, with dramatic difference in performance, saying that we're no longer having this highly correlated, simple one-story driver on financial markets, which is back to exactly what you said, that the best recommendation now is to really try to think about your style and your factor investing in terms of what is it that are the factors that drive things. And for us, a very important factor is exactly this issue that if rates are higher for longer, my starting point must be that I have to be in companies that are not vulnerable to rates staying higher for longer.
The one thing that gives me, you know, more optimistic on equities, thinking about like 1 to 2 years, like through the end of 2016 or 2025, is there's a macro environment that still feels like generally supportive for equities to do well, but you also have the micro level kind of thematic idea of whether it's AI, the obesity drugs, there's other kind of thematics. So it's rare that you kind of get to me a kind of a confluence where like the macro story could be supportive and you have all these kind of micro level stories.
Yeah, in your language, you can both have a beta market and an alpha market, because you have alpha in the stories and the themes that you like. And those things could push on both fronts and of course fuel those stocks that will benefit from both drivers.
Now on the beta point, it kind of goes back to your comment about, on the one hand, you know, high growth, higher for longer could be good for earnings, but higher rates, bad for valuations. Like, how do you kind of balance it out?
Exactly.
It's something that, you know, I'm thinking about, that, you know, the markets and the investors we've been discussing are kind of using this idea of, like, there could be soft landing, hard landing, or no landing. Now, hard landing, that's a recession. That's kind of easy. The other ones are sort of subjective, how you want to define it. I would think of soft landing means like, okay, the economy slows back to something like 2% growth, 2% inflation from elevated levels. No landing is we stay at like 3%+ for both. It's not clear to me which of the soft landing or no landing is actually better for equities,
Yeah. You
know, because then in the former, the soft, like rates come down, that's good for valuations, but earnings should be okay. The other one, rates are higher, but the economy is just kind of on fire. That can't necessarily be a bad thing for equities. Which one is relatively better? I think it's probably more of like where you want to be owned in the markets, as opposed to both could have the S&P at 5,500 by year, and it's an example, but what leads it could be very, very different.
I think we are firmly in the no landing scenario, because it feels unstable in the sense that we both have high inflation. And yes, you're right, it does give good fundamentals for companies, but we will not see high inflation forever, because the Fed will simply not allow that. So that's why you're absolutely right. It becomes really important how you think about it as an investor in terms of, is it a hard landing, no landing, or soft landing? And I still think that the data in the last several months, including the data we've had more recently, it argues for the no landing scenario, which feels quite unstable in the sense that, well, the Fed will simply not allow inflation to continue to tick higher.
I think that also goes back to your point about Americans wanting to travel a lot. They don't want to land. Get your plane tickets right now. That's the story, the takeaway from where we are. So I think it's very interesting sort of times. I think everyone's sort of, you know, kind of reassessing almost like, why didn't things kind of play out last year like they would have anticipated, and like, what's the right kind of regime to think about it right now? At the beginning of the year, I wrote a note, you know, asking sort of five questions or things that make you go, and one would be, you know, there's been so much focus, will we have a soft or hard landing? No one really kind of almost stopped to ask, like, well, what are we landing to? Yeah. And it feels like what we're landing to is a higher level than people would have assumed. And so, you know, again, the no landing, soft landing, you can debate it. But like, instead of landing back at that sort of pre-pandemic 4% kind of nominal GDP, I think we're landing at something higher, at least for the time being. And it's not what people sort of anticipated.
And I think that's a good way of rounding out our conversation, because as investors, many of us grew up from 2008 to 2022 saying, hey, this is the way the world works. Interest rates are zero forever. You just buy equities. The buy everything rally. It was relatively simple. Everyone was invested in something that generally was going up. And now we're suddenly here, hey, maybe that's not how the world works. And maybe we all now need to get used to how hard as it is to say we're not going back to that. We are in this new regime where interest rates are higher for longer, and we now need to construct our portfolios accordingly.
I think it was in 2014, 2013, when Larry Summers gave a speech, I think, the IMF, using the secular stagnation. This was 4 years into the recovery from the global financial crisis, where people realized, like, maybe this lower for longer is the case. It could be, like, take us now 4 years from the pandemic beginning to realize, like, this is actually structurally a different regime that will play out the rest of this
it
decade.
It takes time for all of us. When you have a habit and you're used to doing something and you've done this for your whole life, it takes time to change your habit.
It's not
and
easy.
Our habit of saying, oh, interest rates have to be zero. So they're probably going back to zero, and maybe they're not going back to zero. So maybe our habit now has to be in financial markets that, hey, maybe we are actually now in a more normal situation rather than the unusual situation we had from 2008 to 2022.
It's hard to change your thinking when you're kind of anchored on something for so long and it worked. So
exactly.
Well, with that, Jason Torsten, very thought-provoking dialogue, plenty of considerations when it comes to positioning you've left our listeners with. So looking forward to part four at some point, though. Torsten, Jason, thank you both again for spending some time with our listeners, our clients today on How Should I Be Positioned?
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for joining us today, Torsten.
Absolutely.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.